Roseanne, host of the California Dreaming Podcast, a show that delves into the darker side of the not-so-golden state. Together, we will visit some of the most unhinged and chilling crimes that ever shook California. Join me as I take you on a journey into a new story each week with a different backdrop from all around California. From the bright lights and glamour of Hollywood to the picturesque and tranquil wine country, no crime, no town, nobody is off limits. Listen to California Dreaming on the Orbital Jigsaw Network or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Thank you.
Hi, this is Pernilla from the True Crime Sweden podcast. If you thought Sweden was all about IKEA and Swedish meatballs, you are in for a big surprise. We do have our fair share of crimes in Sweden too, and I'm here to tell you all about them. I bring up all sorts of true crime cases, and by listening, you get to learn a little bit about how the legal system works in another country. For example, I did an episode about the case that created the Stockholm Syndrome. You've probably heard about the Stockholm Syndrome, but do you know the case behind it? Well, besides talking about true crime, I end each episode with a little fun fact about Sweden, something that is really appreciated by my listeners. And maybe I should add that my podcast is, of course, in English. If you think this sounds interesting, give it a try by searching for True Crime Sweden on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast at. I hope to see you.
Southern Fraud True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. I would like to emphasize that this episode deals with graphic violence against children that listeners may find distressing, so please proceed with caution. Just 7 months before the McDonald murders, the Manson murders had gripped the nation. Five people, including actress Sharon Tate, who was 8 months pregnant, had been brutally slaughtered in Los Angeles. Sharon Tate was the wife of director Roman Polanski, but it would later come out that Charles Manson was probably targeting the previous owner of the home, whom he blamed for his failed music career. The murders were grotesquely sensational. They were front page news for months, and the trial was a circus, with gavel-to-gavel coverage on the news and in papers. Everyone knew about the Manson family, a gang of hippies who had burst into a Hollywood mansion and killed everyone there. The murders were portrayed as ritualistic in the media, and Manson had given specific instructions to make the murders as gruesome as possible. As the killers were leaving, they wrote the word pig and Sharon Tate's blood on the front door. As I'm sure you have noticed, Jeffrey McDonald's version of events on the night his family was slaughtered is conveniently similar to the Manson murders. Welcome to episode 29, the conclusion to the family annihilator, Jeffrey McDonald. It's not as if Jeffrey McDonald could have escaped the news of the Manson murders. Even someone living under the proverbial rock would know the basic details of that shocking and gruesome tragedy. But there was also current evidence found in the McDonald home that proves Jeffrey would indeed know the details of the brutality of the Manson family. In his living room, there was a copy of Esquire magazine, which had a long article about the Sharon Tate murders in California. There was a blood smear on the front of this magazine. This was not lost on investigators. They theorized that McDonald attempted to cover up the murders using the article on the Manson family for reference. They also had a theory of the crime, why it happened, and how. I will be using their theory as well as my own to describe that horrific night. Though this was long before DNA technology, we did understand blood typing. And the McDonald family was a statistical anomaly in that they all had different blood types. Once this was discovered, the crime scene started to make sense. There were four different blood types found in the home, and they matched the family exactly. Colette was type A, Jeffrey was type B, Kimberly was type AB, and Kristen was type O. The floor plan of the McDonald home is online, and I will post it on my social media. At trial, they used one marked with the different blood types to piece together what happened that night. Investigators believed that a fight had begun in the master bedroom, probably after Jeffrey McDonald came to bed and found that Kimberly had wet the bed. That's right, Kimberly was the one who wet the bed. The urine's blood type was AB, and it wasn't the first time. In fact, it was something Colette was trying to work out in her child psychology class. Her notebook shows her notes on why children wet the bed past certain ages. Why Jeffrey McDonald lied and said it was Kristen isn't fully understood, especially since it's reasonable to believe that as a doctor, he would understand blood types. The only reason that makes sense is that he didn't want people to get to the why of the fight. Children Kristen's age often wet the bed, but 5-year-old Kimberly's incontinence was a touchy subject in his marriage. Kimberly was the more sensitive of the girls. Even Jeffrey described her this way while bragging that Kristen was a total tomboy. Kimmy was a mama's girl, and along with wetting the bed, she was also afraid of the dark and, in general, a timid little girl. She had probably asked her mother if she could lie in bed with her until her daddy came to bed. It's not a stretch to believe that Jeffrey came to bed and found Kimberly there and found the sheets wet. And then he became enraged. He was a fastidious man who had showered multiple times that day, so you can imagine his impatience with a 5-year-old that still wet the bed. Also consider the amphetamines he was on and that he hadn't slept since Saturday evening. Remember, he worked a 24-hour shift at the Hamlet ER that Sunday before going to work on the base on Monday at 6 a.m. The murders occurred sometime around 3 a.m. Tuesday, the next morning. At best, he hadn't slept in about 36 hours, but it was probably closer to 48 hours by that time. I have read several different insomnia studies, and one published in the Journal of Neuroscience in 2014 said after just 24 hours of sleep deprivation, psychosis can occur, and that study was not factoring in amphetamine abuse. Regardless of whether it was the pills he was taking or lack of sleep, we do know that he became enraged, possibly to the point of psychosis. At this point, only Jeffrey McDonald knows the truth of what happened. However, the blood did tell a story. The fight began in the master bedroom between Jeffrey and Colette. Investigators believe she may have thrown a hairbrush at him, causing the small bruise on his forehead. I can't see Colette striking the first blow unless it was to protect her children. I think it's more likely he started slapping and punching, and she fought back. Enraged, he then stepped into the small utility room and picked up a 2x3 from some leftover wood where he had made slats for Kimmy's bed. Kimberly McDonald's blood was found in the doorway of their bedroom. We cannot know if she was present for the whole fight, but it makes sense that at least part of his original story was true. As I've said before, the best lies have a little bit of truth in them. I think he did come to bed and find it soaked with urine. I think he then carried Kimberly to her own room and came back to berate Colette about it. Then Kimberly, maybe hearing the fight, came to stand in the doorway to see what was happening and was struck in the head. Some people believe it was an accident, that he was swinging at Colette when Kimmy walked in. But the back of her skull was shattered. It seems more like a deliberate injury, rather than she was sideswiped as he swung the club at Colette. I think it's more possible that he heard her screaming, turned around in rage, and struck her with a club. This was the point of no return. His assault on Colette was horrible, and yes, he likely would have done jail time, but she may have lived. Once he grabbed the club and hit Kimberly, any rational explanation of a fight between a married couple that got out of control is no longer believable. He now has to finish it. He bashed Colette in the head with a wooden club, raising it high enough to scrape the ceiling over his head. She falls to the floor unconscious, and he probably thought she was dead. At this point, his choice was made, and he chose himself. He went back into the living room and checked the article on the Manson murders in the Esquire magazine, leaving a swipe of blood that was a mixture of Colette and Kimberly's blood types on the cover. Jeffrey McDonald's blood type was B, and it was only found in two places in the home, on the bathroom sink and in front of the kitchen sink, right where the cabinet under the sink is, where they kept latex gloves for dishwashing. Not in the living room where he claimed he was assaulted. Not even in the bedroom where he more than likely fought violently with his wife. But he did bleed. Blood type B was found in two places in the home where none of the attacks occurred. I think he went to the bathroom first and pulled a scalpel from his supply closet located in there. Jeffrey McDonald oddly kept scalpels in the house, along with painkillers, amphetamines, and even liquid Thorazine, along with other numerous medical supplies. There are photos of this closet, and it wasn't just the black doctor's bag we are all familiar with. He had a veritable pharmacy in his bathroom and enough emergency medical supplies to stock an ambulance. Jeffrey then went to the bathroom mirror and carefully made a precise incision in his side. He knew exactly where to slice in order to collapse a lung. One lung, not necessarily a life-threatening injury, but enough to land him in a hospital bed. I think he saw the blood drops on the sink and realized that, number one, he needed gloves to finish this heinous plan, and number two, he needed to mention he checked his wounds in the bathroom right away to explain those drops. He took care of number one first. He went to the kitchen, where latex gloves were kept under the sink. Colette used the surgical gloves that Jeffrey brought home to wash the dishes. As I said, there were type B blood drops found right under this cabinet. While he was there, he grabbed two knives and an ice pick. He would have been thinking of the multiple killers in the Manson murders, each with their own weapon. That makes sense. And it's also proven that the weapons found right outside the back door and in the master bedroom close to Colette's body were from the McDonald home. Even Jeffrey McDonald has never tried to deny this. This last part is the hardest, the most heartbreaking, the most visceral. Jeffrey McDonald then went to his daughter Kristen's room, the baby, the only witness left. Only she hadn't seen anything. It's difficult to picture that in my head, and it's even more difficult to say what happened next. Jeffrey McDonald stabbed his 2-year-old daughter to death, 33 times with a knife, 16 times with an ice pick, on her chest and back. Author Joe McGinnis speculated that he actually held that baby on his lap as he did it. Physicians have said that the location of Kristen's wounds were specific. It wasn't the frenzied stabbing or slashing of a madman. It was someone who knew where to stab to bring death quickly, her heart and her lungs. It wasn't just a guess, either. There were no corresponding holes in her pajamas, so her shirt was lifted. And don't forget, she had defensive wounds. She was aware, even if she couldn't understand what was happening to her. And she knew it was her daddy that was hurting her. But what Jeffrey McDonald didn't expect was the fight left in his wife. Colette McDonald evidently had come too. And she had nothing left to lose, nothing left to fight for except her last living child, so she staggered into Kristen's room. At this point, mortally injured, she knew her husband was a monster. She probably knew she was going to die, but she made it into her baby's room. We know from the bloodstains that Colette was in Kristen's room, on her bed. Her type A blood was sprayed on the wall behind Kristen's bed, and the puddle of blood in the floor was also Colette's. It's obvious she ran in there hoping to protect Kristen. Traces of Kristen's type O blood were found on her hands. She jumped on the bed, probably trying to hold Kristen, and that's when he hit her again. The final blow to her head, crushing her skull like an eggshell, just as her mother later said. Colette's own blood was found on her pajama pants and legs. This makes sense if you picture her crouching on her daughter's bed, trying to shield Kristen as she begged for their lives, only to be hit again and falling forward. Once they both were dead, Jeffrey went and stripped the top sheet and the bedspread from the master bedroom. As he did this, 22 fibers from his torn pajama top scattered onto the bottom sheet. He then picked up Kimberly from the hallway and carried her in the sheet back to the bedroom. This direct contact transferred Kimmy's blood to his pajama top and onto the sheet. As he carried Kimmy in the sheet, Her blood dripped onto the hallway floor leading into her bedroom. He placed her in the bed in a sleeping position, leaving 14 blue fibers under her covers as he pulled them up to her chin. As she lay dying, he then struck her again with a club. The coroner would not confirm for sure how many actual blows Kimberly suffered, but she did have 2 skull fractures, and the blood spray on the wall and the ceiling in her room indicates that she was hit again. There was even faint cast-off blood from Colette found on Kimberly's wall. That's because the club was still dripping from his attack on her in Kristen's bedroom. Colette's blood drops were also found in the hall leading into Kimberly's room. Jeffrey McDonald then stabbed his older daughter in the neck around 8 to 10 times. Though she had bled her life's blood out on the floor in the hallway of her parents' bedroom, Jeffrey needed to make sure her wounds matched her mother and sister's. But she was mostly dead or close to it when he stabbed her. As I've said, the majority of her blood was on the floor near her parents' room, but she also bled directly onto the sheet she was moved in. And we know this is the order of events because some of Kristen's blood, type O, along with Colette's type A, were found on Kimberly's bed. He definitely had already stabbed Kristen before he went to finish off Kimberly. Then he got the bedspread and the same sheet he had used to carry Kimmy and went back to Kristen's bedroom. He picked up Colette's body, wrapping her in the sheet, perhaps to stop from getting any more blood on himself or to stop from dripping as he moved her. However, there were fabric transfers and blood on the sheet that matched the cuffs of Jeffrey's pajama top. Investigators also matched one of Colette's cuffs to a bloodstain on the sheet. Jeffrey stepped in the pool of her blood as he carried her body back to the master bedroom. The bare footprint leading out of Kristen's room was in type A blood, Colette's type. Even Jeffrey McDonald agreed that it was his footprint because the supposed killers would have had on shoes. After he carried Colette back to the master bedroom, he stabbed her with one of the knives. With his 2 daughters dead, he had returned to the bedroom he shared with his wife to finish setting up the scene. He had already stabbed her with the old hickory knife, but not yet the ice pick. He took off his pajama top and covered her chest with it. He knew that the top was covered in her blood, and he would have to explain why. It would be easy to say he was trying to help Colette by placing his pajama top on top of her. There was another reason as well. The FBI lab pieced together Jeff's pajama top because it was ripped all the way down the front, as if someone grabbed him and yanked. This is why investigators found a plethora of the distinctive blue threads in the master bedroom. During the fight with Colette, she grabbed his shirt and it was ripped. Thinking quickly, he knew if he laid his pajama top on Colette, it would look like he was trying to help her, not cover up what he did. But then he thought back to the Esquire article and the multiple intruders with their multiple weapons. So he got the ice pick and stabbed her 21 more times, perhaps not realizing that he was doing it through the pajama top. That created another problem he would have to explain later, which he did, or tried to, by saying he woke up with his pajama top twisted around his arms. He would later elaborate in court that while struggling with his assailants, his top was pulled over his head and he used it as a shield. I'll come back to this later when we talk about his trial. After this, he needed to make sure the murder weapons were free of his fingerprints and blood. Even though he had gotten rubber gloves at some point, he still worried about evidence on the weapons. So he wiped them on the mat from his bathroom. And then he probably thought this might seem odd. Why would drugged-out hippie intruders bother wiping knives? So he laid the bath mat over Colette's abdomen. Then he went out the back door and laid one of the knives along with the ice pick right outside the door. Since the second knife was found near Colette's body, he probably just forgot about that one. Investigators did speculate that Colette may have gone and gotten her own knife to try and defend herself and her children, and that's the knife found near her body. This knife was the Geneva Forge knife, and it was dull and bent, and the medical examiner and investigators said it was not the knife used on Colette or the girls. Their wounds don't match it. But Jeffrey McDonald had some minor cuts on his body. So minor, they didn't require stitches. There were also some tears in his shirt that could match that dull knife. So it is possible that Colette tried. It's also possible that the knife was so dull, he bent it while trying to stab her and then discarded it near Colette's body and forgot about it. Since Colette's blood is not found in the kitchen where the knives were located, I find this second scenario more believable. Once they all were dead, and he had used the old hickory knife and the ice pick on Colette, he went back to the living room to set up the scene there. He merely set the coffee table on its side and knocked over a potted plant. We know this is probably the order of events because near the couch was a mixture of type A and AB blood, Colette and Kimberly's types. His eyeglasses were laying on the floor nearby, and they had a drop of type O, Kristen's blood type, on one of the lenses. So he would have had to stage the living room after he murdered all of them. All three of their blood types were found there. But again, I stress, his type, blood type B, was not found there. The living room couch is where he was supposedly attacked by three male intruders, where he claimed he was hit in the head and stabbed with a knife and warded off blows from an ice pick. And yet there's no blood, no blue fibers from his pajama top, literally no evidence at all that he was injured in that living room. After setting the scene, he went and made the phone calls. This was before 911, so he dialed 0 for the operator. He pretended to barely be able to talk and gave his address. A few minutes later, when the MPs weren't breaking down his door, he called again. He then went and lay down next to Colette and waited for the MPs to show up. At this time, I'm going to pause to hear a word from our sponsors. On April 6, 1970, Army CID investigators interrogated Jeffrey McDonald. As he was first advised of his rights, he joked, sounding very ominous. He quickly found that nothing was funny, so he started telling his story again. He spoke quickly, with very little emotion, stammering with ums and I thinks, and often joking inappropriately. This was only 6 weeks after the slaughter of his entire family. Maybe you shouldn't judge people by nervous mannerisms, but it is difficult to sympathize when you read the transcripts. There is one thing about this interrogation, though. It would haunt him for the next 10 years. Once he told his story on record, he was bound to these details forever. He couldn't yet know what physical evidence the CID had, so he couldn't necessarily form his story around it. As the investigators started asking harder questions, Jeffrey McDonald kept saying he didn't know, or his answer would be pure conjecture. He asked for a brief coffee break, but left for an hour and a half. When he came back, CID Chief Franz Grebner took the gloves off. Now Jeffrey became hostile and sarcastic. He also mistakenly said the word bed instead of couch when describing his struggle with the assailants. That's quite a telling slip, and he didn't do it just once. He said bed 3 times, probably because the real fight was with Colette in the bedroom. At one point towards the end, one of the investigators asked, "What kind of man are you?" This is when Jeffrey McDonald sobbed as he called himself bright and hardworking and a great doctor who loved his wife. To me, it's not really surprising that the only tears he could muster were for himself. After this display, Franz Grebner took out the photograph of a woman Jeffrey had once worked with named Tina. It was from when he was stationed briefly at Fort Sam Houston before the move to Fort Bragg with Colette and the girls. The young woman was posing with his green beret on her head, suggestively lying on a motel bed. At this, Jeffrey McDonald grumbled, "You guys are more thorough than I thought." Just hours after this interview, the provost marshal on base put out a statement declaring that Captain Jeffrey McDonald was a suspect. Minutes after the news broke, his mother called a friend and pulled strings to get him an attorney quickly. Bernard Siegel from Philadelphia was a left-leaning, flamboyant lawyer. He had worked with the ACLU and mainly defended draft dodgers. He seemed an odd choice to defend a Green Beret, but he was renowned in Philly and came highly recommended. He also notoriously said he enjoyed the theatrics of criminal law. Keep that one in your back pocket. Less than a month later, on May 1st, the Army formally charged Jeffrey McDonald with the murder of his family. At this point, Mildred and Freddie Kassab were convinced that their son-in-law was innocent, and they were shocked when he was charged. They defended him in the press and wrote supportive letters to him. An Army Article 32 hearing was convened on July 5, 1970 and ran through September. Bernie Siegel mounted an aggressive defense, a full defense for what was really a preliminary hearing. He cross-examined the Army investigators rigorously and fairly pointed out many messy things. Siegel presented evidence that the CID had not properly managed the crime scene and lost several items of critical evidence, including pieces of the rubber surgical gloves found in the master bedroom and a single layer of skin found under one of Colette's fingernails. Also, a point that isn't necessarily the fault of the Army CID, the hospital had thrown out Jeffrey McDonald's pajama pants. By the time the CID realized this, it was too late. The pants had been thrown in an incinerator. There is no way to know what evidence was lost on these pants. At the Article 32 hearing, Bernie Siegel also claimed to have located a suspect, a woman named Helena Stokely, who supposedly matched the description of the floppy-haired hat woman Jeffrey McDonald claimed was there that night. Stokely was an Army brat who had only graduated from high school in June of 1969, less than a year before the murders, and she had a severe drug problem. She had already been kicked out of her parents' home for her addictions. A heroin addict, she also dabbled in LSD, mescaline, coke, pot, and just about anything she could get her hands on. She first implicated herself in this case just a couple of days after the murders when talking to a drug counselor. She told him she had no memory of her whereabouts that night. This kicked off 13 years of Stokely confessing, then recanting, then denying she ever confessed, and then circling back around to saying it was possible because she had no memory of that night. She was a damn mess. The problem was, her neighbor turned her in to Bernie Siegel after he heard about the $5,000 reward the Kassabs were offering for information about the killers. Much later, during Jeffrey McDonald's many appeals, the neighbor was tracked down. His story changed and he was given a polygraph, which he failed. It's obvious he just wanted the reward money and thought his drug-addicted neighbor was an easy target. After the neighbor testified, CID investigator Ivory went and questioned Stokely. She said she didn't know anything about the murders, didn't even know where the house was, and all she remembered about that night was going for a drive alone. She did not remember even being with three men that evening, much less accompanying these men while they carried out gruesome murders. I would also like to point out that though she did give some false confessions over the years, she never once named the three men she was supposed to have been with, the three men that Jeffrey McDonald insisted had attacked him and brutally murdered his wife and children. Bernie Siegel grilled investigator William Ivory on the stand at the Article 32 hearing for not taking Helena Stokely more seriously. Ivory couldn't hide his contempt for the very idea of Stokely's involvement, and though his contempt was justified, it did hurt the Army's case. And the Army had already been raked over the coals for allowing so many officers in the home that night and mishandling some of the evidence. On October 13, 1970, the hearing officer issued a report recommending that charges be dismissed against McDonald because they were, quote, not true, and he recommended that civilian authorities investigate Stokely. But publicly, the Army merely said that the charges were dropped due to insufficient evidence. It is telling that they refused to say they did not believe Jeffrey McDonald killed his family, nor would they publicly name Helena Stokely as a potential suspect. In December, Jeffrey McDonald applied for and received an honorable discharge from the Army and returned to New York City where he went back to work. Now that he was cleared, he was enjoying the notoriety. He gave many interviews and was sending out feelers to a lot of authors he hoped would write his story. He was already planning to profit off of his family's annihilation. On November 18, 1970, Jeffrey called Freddie and claimed that he and some Army buddies had tracked down, tortured, and killed one of the murderers. Freddie had gotten in the habit of recording these calls. He was already suspicious and angry that Jeffrey would not give up the Article 32 transcripts. When he questioned this outlandish story, Jeffrey refused to provide any more details. Freddie did not believe him, and honestly, why would anyone? If he truly found one of the suspects, why wouldn't he turn them over to the police in hopes of finding the other killers? Jeffrey later said that he only did this to get Freddie off of his back, and in the following decades, he softened that statement to say that he did it to help assuage the Kassab's grief. He said they could not move on and he was trying to help. And clearly, he wasn't having any trouble moving on. On December 15, 1970, Jeffrey appeared on the Dick Cavett Show, during which he made inappropriate jokes and whined about being investigated by the Army. Let me repeat that. He went on a late-night talk show and joked with the host about the night his family was murdered. He also claimed he had been knocked unconscious and stabbed over 23 times. He said, quote, "I could have died very easily. I was in an intensive care unit for several days and had surgery, you know, chest tubes, in my chest." Well, we know that's bullshit. He did get a chest tube, but it was merely a precaution. If this sounds bad to us, imagine how the Kassabs felt watching this. It was the last straw. Freddie finally got his copy of the transcripts on Christmas Eve. He and Mildred spent Christmas through the New Year reading, and after that, they were done with their son-in-law's bullshit. They knew. They knew in their bones he had killed their daughter and grandchildren. At this time, I'm going to pause for another word from our sponsors. Even before Freddie and Mildred got the Article 32 transcripts, they were working to get the case investigated by civilian authorities, since the Army appeared to have no interest in pursuing the matter further. At one point, Freddie wrote 500 copies of a letter and hand-delivered them in suitcases for every single member of Congress demanding an investigation be opened. What the Kassabs didn't know was that the Army was still interested. Because the Article 32 findings were private, they had no way of knowing that Jeffrey McDonald was still the main suspect. And the CID was also none too pleased with Jeffrey's hamming around in interviews on late shows and splashy magazines. So the CID started a reinvestigation in late 1970. Office space was assigned to Colonel Jack Pruitt and Warrant Officer Peter Kearns. They assembled a team of 8 agents who went back over the entire case. Their first step was to interview Jeffrey McDonald again. Bernie Siegel was there, but they were still able to pull new information out of him. Jeffrey was shown photographs of Helena Stokely, her boyfriend at the time, and a handful of other suspects that had been suggested. He didn't recognize any of them. Pruitt and Kearns concluded that while mistakes were made, the evidence collected at the crime scene was not contaminated by the military police or the medics. They then took the evidence to the FBI for the first time. The chief of the FBI's chemistry division, Paul Stonball, analyzed all of the cuts and puncture holes in pajamas worn by the whole family, as well as the bloodstain patterns on Jeffrey's pajama top. He concluded that all of the puncture holes were perfectly round with no ragged edges, which indicated that the pajama top was stationary when punctured. Think about what that means. No one just lies there as they are being stabbed unless they are already dead. He also found that the old hickory knife was responsible for all of the cuts in Colette's and Kristen's pajamas, while the source of the 2 cuts in McDonald's pajama top was probably the Geneva Forge knife. Remember, I told you, the Geneva Forge knife was bent and dull. It's one the Army felt that Colette may have tried to use to defend herself. Paul Stumball's reconstruction of Jeffrey McDonald's pajama top is legendary. Not only did he conclude that the 4 bloodstains of Colette's on Jeffrey's top had been there before it was torn, he was also able to fold the top in such a way that the 48 holes lined up with 21 stab wounds on Colette made by the ice pick. This would prove to be very powerful testimony at trial. CID investigator William Ivory, the first ranking officer on the scene, also went back over everything. One question mark had always been the club. Jeffrey had claimed he had never seen it before, though he admitted it was possible he had old lumber laying around. William Ivory removed the slats from under Kimberly's bed and was able to match them to the club. By microscopic examination of the wood and also with chemical testing of paint on the wood. Finally, the last weapon was tied to the home. The knives, ice pick, and club were all items belonging to the McDonald family. On June 1, 1972, they submitted their findings in a 10,000-page report to the Department of Justice. They recommended that Jeffrey McDonald be prosecuted for the murder of his family. They had interviewed almost 700 people, and leads other than McDonald were pursued in 32 different states, along with help from the FBI lab. If only the original investigation had been this thorough, Jeffrey McDonald would probably either still be at Leavenworth or long ago executed for his heinous crimes. But between 1972 and 1974, the case sat trapped in limbo at the Justice Department. Because the murders had been committed while Jeffrey McDonald was in the Army, they were hesitant to prosecute in a civilian court. But on April 30, 1974, after the dogged persistence of the Kassabs and Peter Kearns, the Kassab's attorney, Richard Kahn, presented a citizen's complaint against Jeffrey McDonald to the U.S. District Court, requesting a grand jury be convened to indict him for the murders of his family. In August 1974, Justice Department attorney Victor Warhide presented the case to a grand jury, and U.S. District Judge Franklin Dupree was assigned to the hearing. Finally, on January 24, 1975, a grand jury in Raleigh, North Carolina, indicted Jeffrey McDonald, and he was arrested within the hour in California. Within 1 week, he was released on a $100,000 bond. On May 23rd, he was arraigned and officially pled not guilty. Bernie Siegel went to work filing motions to have the charges dismissed based on double jeopardy because of the Article 32 hearing and a violation of McDonald's Sixth Amendment rights to a speedy trial because it had been over 5 years since the murders. On July 29th, Judge Dupree denied both of these motions and ordered a trial date beginning August 18, 1975. But on August 15th, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals stayed the trial, and in January of 1976, a panel of that court, in a 2-1 split, voted to dismiss the indictment on the Sixth Amendment grounds for a speedy trial. A federal appeal was filed by the government to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in a unanimous decision, the indictment was reinstated. By October of 1978, the Fourth Circuit Court officially rejected the double jeopardy arguments, and that following March, the Supreme Court refused to even review that decision. And this was a just ruling. A military Article 32 hearing is akin to a civilian preliminary hearing. It was not a trial, so therefore double jeopardy would not apply. Finally, almost 10 years after their murders, Jeffrey McDonald went to trial for the annihilation of his family. It began in the Raleigh, North Carolina Federal Courthouse on July 16, 1979. In that June of 1979, Jeffrey McDonald signed a contract with author Joe McGinnis to write a book about the case. Remember, I told you he'd been sending out letters to authors and journalists asking that someone cover his case for years, ever since the charges were dismissed from the Article 32 hearing. He had wanted someone to tell his side of the story, but he did not approach any publications without asking for financial compensation. He wasn't looking for an investigation. He was trying to cash in. One of his final battles with Freddie Kassab was over Freddie speaking to a reporter from Life magazine who wanted to write a long investigative piece on the case. Freddie was delighted that the reporter wanted to take on the case, and the magazine had the resources for an extensive investigation. But Jeffrey did not have a financial arrangement with Life magazine. He stammered around, making excuses to Freddie, and then had his lawyer send him a curt notice that the good doctor did not consent to the article by Life magazine, nor would he cooperate. Jeffrey McDonald cared a lot about money. He was living the playboy lifestyle in California, driving a Maserati, living in a luxury condo with his yacht, named the Recovery Room, docked nearby. Even Joe McGinnis later admitted to being initially dazzled by Jeffrey's charm and luxurious lifestyle. Obviously, if he wasn't tried for the murders, and especially if he wasn't guilty, Jeffrey McDonald had every right to move on with his life. However, optics are everything. We know that. How do you think it looked to the people who did grieve for Colette and her daughters? He was already sleeping around before the Article 32 hearing had even started, less than a month after the murders. In the years since, he had been through many women. And let's not forget, he was a serial cheater while married to Colette, and in fact only married her because she got pregnant. Author Joe McGinnis was given full access to Jeffrey McDonald and his defense team during the trial. He sat through every day of that trial. Jeffrey expected that the book would be about his innocence, and per his contract, he was to receive 25% of the profits. However, Joe McGinnis's book, Fatal Vision, published in the spring of 1983, portrayed MacDonald as a narcissistic sociopath who was indeed guilty of murdering his family. Along with Joe McGinnis's narrative, the book has excerpts from court transcripts and sections entitled The Voice of Jeffrey MacDonald, which were based on tape recordings Jeffrey made following his conviction and sent to Joe McGinnis. McGinnis researched the case and MacDonald's life for 3 years after the trial before publishing. During that time, he stayed in contact with Jeffrey MacDonald, writing letters and listening to his recordings. Joe McGinnis said that he struggled mightily in these years. His dawning realization that Jeffrey MacDonald was a monster, coupled with having to still correspond with him to finish the book, was nightmarish. For MacDonald's trial, Bernie Siegel needed a local attorney to act as co-counsel as he wasn't licensed for trial in North Carolina. Wade Smith, a Raleigh local, took the case. He had recently retired from state politics after serving 2 terms undefeated in the state legislature. He was a gracious, gregarious, and respected lawyer in his state. Basically, he was the yin to Bernie's slick New York yang. Bernie referred to him as the Golden Boy. They set about to mount a vigorous defense for Jeffrey MacDonald, hiring a jury consultant from Duke University for $15,000. His staff polled more than 900 people in phone surveys to find the right demographic profile of the ideal juror. They analyzed the data and decided that the ideal jury would be composed of conservative white people over the age of 35, typically a prosecutor's dream jury. Their point was the prosecution would not see that coming, and that because of Jeffrey MacDonald's image and social standing, these were the type of jurors who would identify with him. Jeffrey himself did not like this. He said his gut told him that this was all wrong. In fact, he said it scared the hell out of him. But Bernie soothed him, and they decided to proceed with the recommendation. The consultant was a Duke professor and was himself a young liberal. He remarked, quote, "What Jeff doesn't understand is that it's my friends we want most to get rid of. They all think he's guilty as hell." On the prosecution team, Jim Blackburn replaced original attorney Victor Warhide, who had dropped dead of a heart attack in 1975. Along with Jim Blackburn, co-counsel Brian Murtaugh represented the government. They opened the trial like gangbusters, getting the Esquire magazine entered into evidence on the first day, already laying the groundwork to show how Jeffrey MacDonald got the idea to blame drug-crazed hippies for the murders in the first place. The trial didn't start well for the defense. After that first loss, Judge Dupree then refused to allow expert testimony from a psychiatric evaluation of Jeffrey MacDonald to be allowed into evidence. This evaluation suggested that he did not have the personality type to commit such an abhorrent act against his family. However, the Army had also sent Jeffrey MacDonald to a psychiatrist for evaluation, and that report was not favorable at all. The psychiatrist posited that Jeffrey MacDonald had all the characteristics of a narcissistic psychopath who was capable of killing his family. But Judge Dupree rightly ruled that since no insanity plea had been entered, any psychiatric testimony was irrelevant, and he would not bog down the trial with contradictory testimony from experts on both sides. The prosecution's star witness was FBI analyst Paul Stumbaugh, who had figured out the significance of Jeffrey MacDonald's pajama top, the bloodstains of Colette and Kimberly, the different tears and holes. He was a very compelling witness. He testified that MacDonald's pajama top had 48 small, smooth, and cylindrical ice pick holes through it. In order for this to have happened, it would have had to remain stationary, and this was unlikely if he had wrapped it around his hands to defend himself from the blows as he claimed he had. Stumbaugh also demonstrated how all 48 holes could have been made by 21 thrusts of the ice pick, the same number of times that Colette had been stabbed with it, and in the identical pattern, meaning that she had been stabbed repeatedly after the pajama top was laying on her chest. Remember, Jeffrey MacDonald admitted he put that top on his wife's chest. Then, out of nowhere, Jim Blackburn and Brian Murtaugh staged an impromptu reenactment of the supposed attack on Jeffrey MacDonald. Murtaugh wrapped a similar pajama top around his hands and tried to fend off a series of blows that Blackburn was inflicting on him with a similar ice pick. Over Bernie Siegel's loud objections, they achieved what they set out to do. First, they proved that the holes made during an attack like that were jagged and torn, not the perfectly cylindrical holes like those found on Jeffrey McDonald's pajama top. More importantly, Brian Murtaugh received a small cut on his left hand. And it's not as though Jim Blackburn was stabbing with the same ferocity a crazed killer would have. And Jeffrey McDonald had no such wounds on his hands or arms. The stunt was the kind of thing you see in movies, and it was incredibly effective and damaging to the defense. And Bernie Siegel, who claimed to love the theatrics of criminal law, was incensed. He would never recover from his anger at this moment in the trial. The rest of his case was tainted by his own rage at the prosecutors. Another piece of damaging evidence against McDonald was an audio tape of the April 6, 1970 interrogation by military investigators. Listening to this tape, the jury heard his matter-of-fact, indifferent recitation of the murders. They heard him become angry and defensive in response to being accused of murdering his family. He had said how could they think that he, a successful man with a beautiful family, could have killed them in cold blood for no reason. And then the jury heard the investigators answer that by confronting Jeffrey McDonald with his many extramarital affairs. Remember that part of his interrogation where he had smirked and said, "Oh, you guys are more thorough than I thought." But despite these wins, the prosecution did have one stumbling block, and that was the lack of motive. There was no history of violence or domestic abuse against his wife or children. Once the prosecution rested, Bernie Siegel called Helena Stokely to the witness stand, intent on extracting a confession from her. During the 9 years after the murders had been committed, she had made several contradictory statements, sometimes saying she was present when the murders happened, other times saying she had no memory of where she even was that night. And the defense was not about to go into Helena Stokely's medical problems and how they probably affected her mental state. As a result of her addictions, in the 9 years since the murders, Stokely had contracted hepatitis, she had had a stroke, and was diagnosed with schizoid personality disorder. The woman they put on the stand came off as pitiful and sick, but not confused. She firmly denied any involvement in the murders. There would be no dramatic revelations from this tragic creature. Helena Stokely would die just 4 years later from pneumonia and cirrhosis. It was days before her body was even discovered. She was only 32 years old. And as for other proof of her presence at the crime scene, there was none. There is not one shred of physical evidence linking her to the murders. Hair and fingerprint samples were taken from her in 1971 and did not match anything at the crime scene then, nor in later years during McDonald's numerous appeals. After Helena's testimony, Siegel argued for testimony to be allowed from witnesses to whom she had confessed. But with the absence of any physical evidence connecting her to the scene, Judge Dupree refused. Beyond the lack of physical evidence, her history of drug abuse and conflicting stories over the years had damaged any credibility on her past claims. McDonald's defense called forensic expert James Thornton to the stand. He unsuccessfully tried to refute the government's contention that the pajama top was stationary on Colette's chest. Rather than wrapped around McDonald's wrists as he warded off blows by conducting an experiment of his own in court, he put a similar pajama top on a ham, moving it back and forth on a spinning tray while he stabbed it with an ice pick. Suffice to say, it was not nearly as moving as the demonstration Blackburn and Murtaugh had given. The defense also called several character witnesses. His mother and several friends and colleagues got up to speak up for the esteemed doctor. On cross-examination, Blackburn asked each one of them one question. Were you at 544 Castle Drive during the early morning hours of February 17, 1970? His simplicity was effective. Jeffrey McDonald finally took the stand and would be the last witness for the defense. Under Bernie Siegel's direct examination, Jeffrey emphatically denied committing the murders. He performed fairly well with Bernie, despite his own hatred for the judge and prosecution. He spoke lovingly of his wife and daughters, and even mustered some tears. He gave the impression of a fine, upstanding physician who only sought to rebuild his life and was being persecuted by his in-laws and the federal government. However, when Jim Blackburn cross-examined him, Jeffrey McDonald could offer no explanation for the mountains of physical evidence. Over and over he said, "I don't know," or it would be pure conjecture if I answered that, I have no recollection of that, etc. He grew more and more hostile the more Blackburn needled him. Of course, he wasn't required to testify, and like most murderers, he was his own worst enemy on the stand. The jury saw the sarcasm, rancor, and loathing he had towards the prosecution. They did not see a grieving father and husband. As Jim Blackburn said in his closing, "If we convince you by the evidence that he did it, we don't have to show you that he is the sort of person that could have done it." But really, Jeffrey showed that himself. When Siegel rose to give his closing statement, he led with a disgusting and insensitive remark. Quote, "Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there has been a tragedy, but we haven't talked about the real tragedy in this case yet." So the slaughter of a pregnant woman and her two little girls wasn't the real tragedy. According to Bernie Siegel and his client, the real tragedy was the suffering of Jeffrey McDonald in the years since. He went on to rant for 3 hours and 10 minutes about the destruction of Jeffrey McDonald's life by the American justice system. The defense was only granted 3 hours and 15 minutes to begin with. They had planned for Siegel to speak for 2 hours and leave the rest to Wade Smith, the local lawyer with the right accent and a much softer touch. Someone who might have been able to get the jury to ignore the overwhelming physical evidence. At the 3-hour and 10-minute mark, the judge warned Siegel. He hadn't even gotten to talking about Helena Stokely yet, as he was so caught up in his rant against the system. He had to squeeze in his accusations against her in the last 4 minutes he spoke, leaving his co-counsel only 60 seconds to repair the damage his ego had wrought. Judge Dupree called a recess, and Wade Smith sought out Jim Blackburn to make a deal. It all boiled down to just 2 hometown lawyers who still had to live and practice in Raleigh, North Carolina, long after the media circus, Bernie Siegel, and Jeffrey McDonald were gone. Jim Blackburn had 40 minutes on rebuttal. He gave Wade Smith 10 minutes of that. Wade Smith spoke softly as he reminded the jury of the horror they had seen in the crime scene photos, juxtaposed with the happy family photos the defense had presented. His words were, "It can't be true." Wade Smith was smart enough to lean on the age-old tactic of no motive. Now, the prosecution doesn't have to give a motive, but we all know damn good and well it's better if they do. So, Jim Blackburn got up for his 30 minutes and gave them one. He said that obviously Jeffrey McDonald didn't slaughter his entire family over his daughter's bedwetting. He argued that the murders happened after an escalation. He pointed out that he didn't say Jeffrey McDonald had been a bad person his whole life. Particularly, Blackburn said that McDonald had not been a bad person in the almost 10 years since his family was murdered. I disagree. He was, and still is, a piece of shit. But Blackburn's point was, Jeffrey McDonald lost his temper. He struck out, and the consequence was so great, there was no coming back. Faced with the choice of turning himself in for his assault on Colette and Kimberly, he chose to save himself and murder his baby, Kristen, in cold blood. That was his motive. This was an ugly, awful night that was possibly made worse by his lack of sleep and use of amphetamines. He lost control. And you know, if he had turned himself in, maybe he could have made a plea deal that would have meant he would one day walk out of prison. But he chose himself over his family and made the conscious decision to end their lives. You don't bash in your wife and 5-year-old daughter's skulls without malice, and you damn sure don't stab a baby to death unless you are a monster. At this time, I'm going to pause for a final word from our sponsors. On August 29, 1979, Jeffrey McDonald was convicted of 1 count of first-degree murder in the death of Kristen and 2 counts of second-degree murder in the deaths of Colette and Kimberly. The jury took less than 7 hours to deliberate. Bernie Siegel had gone with a consultant's profile, and the jury was made up of the kind of fine, upstanding citizens they thought would never believe that Jeffrey McDonald was a monster. They were wrong. Among the jurors was another former Green Beret and a retired police officer. But I don't think any jury consultant could have chosen a jury that would believe Jeffrey McDonald. Even if you could dismiss the physical evidence that practically screamed out in condemnation, there was no escaping the real Jeffrey McDonald. His cold, narcissistic, and nasty personality was evident to everyone in that courtroom. Judge Franklin Dupree sentenced Jeffrey McDonald to life in prison for each of the murders, to be served consecutively, not concurrently. This was the harshest sentence he could give because the death penalty was not applicable under federal law. Joe McGinnis made an incredible point in his book, Fatal Vision. He had been with Jeffrey McDonald through the entire process. He had watched every minute of the trial. And one of the things that struck him most was that when Helena Stokely testified, there was no reaction at all from Jeffrey. This was the woman who had supposedly participated in the brutal slaughter of his entire family, and he watched her with the same bored expression Joe McGinnis had seen on his face as he watched TV. Jeffrey McDonald showed more visible anger towards the judge, the prosecution, his in-laws, nearly everyone but her. He just sat there looking bored and doodling on a legal pad while she testified. Why? Because she didn't do it. Joe McGinnis also uncovered the amphetamine problem. After he was interrogated, but before the Article 32 hearing, Jeffrey's military attorney asked him to write out what he remembered, to put it on paper. McGinnis found this handwritten document in a box along with the rest of Jeffrey McDonald's court papers. Jeffrey began by saying they had eaten dinner at 5:45 that evening and he may have taken a diet pill. He couldn't remember for sure. He said he had been running a weight control program for his unit and volunteered himself to encourage participation. Jeffrey McDonald was an extremely fit man. He admitted in these notes that he had lost 13 to 15 pounds in the past 3 weeks leading up to the murders, and he had done it using a drug called Escitrol, which was banned by the FDA in 1981 once we finally understood more about the dangers of these stimulants. The side effects from abuse of that drug were insomnia, tenseness and irritability, hyperactivity, confusion, violent or aggressive behavior, hallucinations, and even psychosis. Even his neighbors had noticed his extreme weight loss, fatigue, and pallor in the weeks before the murders. In Jeffrey's notes, he says, quote, "The CID knows nothing about the possible diet pill. If I did take it, it's conceivable that my urine and blood, 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, would still have some residue." 11:30 a.m. Tuesday after the murders would be approximately 8 hours after they occurred. But his blood was tested, you may think, and he tested clean. Sure, he did. The chemist would have had to have been instructed to test for amphetamines, and back then, no one was looking for amphetamines in blood tests. They didn't know how dangerous they were, so they didn't have the laboratory equipment necessary to detect them. Even today, a simple blood test will not show certain drugs unless you specifically test for that drug. I have worked in human resources, and there are 5, 10, and 15 panel tests, depending on how detailed of an analysis the company wants and is willing to pay for. Typically, employers are only looking for illegal drugs. Well, it was no different in 1970, and amphetamines were not illegal. In fact, they were widely prescribed. Escitrol was in the top 200 selling drugs by the time it was banned. The point to all of this is, at the Article 32 hearing, Jeffrey McDonald and Bernie Siegel realized the Army CID had not found anything in his blood and were not looking for signs of drug abuse. If the prosecution had found out, it could have been motive. After all, Jeffrey was accusing drug-crazed hippies. What if he was drug-crazed himself? But it also could have been mitigating circumstances if Jeffrey McDonald had admitted what he had done. Even by the late 70s, doctors were beginning to understand what amphetamines could do. Escitrol was taken off the market less than 2 years after Jeffrey McDonald was convicted. But it would not have been mitigating circumstances in the murder of Kristen McDonald. The stabbing of his youngest daughter was not done in a moment of anger or the so-called heat of passion. And besides, I don't think it would have ever crossed his mind to tell the truth. Narcissists don't think like that. There was one other option that did cross his mind, though. There was a suitcase sitting in the McDonald bedroom near the footboard of the bed. The suitcase was empty, and though it was not blood splattered, there was blood underneath the suitcase. Colette's type A blood. So it could not have been there before the murders. It was set by the bed after Colette had already bled in that room. The implication is obvious. For a brief moment, Jeffrey McDonald thought about running. But then he realized he would be walking away from his career and have to start over as a nobody. No narcissist would do that either. Narcissists are self-centered and manipulative. People that have antisocial personality disorder, which is the clinical term now preferred instead of a sociopath, are on the extreme side of narcissism. And I am comfortable with armchair diagnosing Jeffrey McDonald with this. The distinctive traits of the disorder include a lack of guilt or shame, a lack of empathy, feelings of entitlement and self-importance, arrogance, and selfishness in relationships, among other things. It is more than fair to say that Jeffrey McDonald was selfish in his marriage. He chronically cheated on Colette, left her alone with the children as much as he could, and was actually planning on staying in New York with a girlfriend for a month while letting Colette think he was in Russia with the Army's boxing team. And don't forget that they were so pressed for money. A month in New York City isn't cheap now, and wasn't cheap in 1970 either. And this is where Jeffrey McDonald differs from other family annihilators. Criminologists have come to distinguish family annihilators of four main types: self-righteous, anomic, disappointed, and paranoid. The self-righteous type blames others, often their wives or estranged wives, for their downfall. Jeffrey McDonald is definitely self-righteous, but he wasn't in the middle of a downfall. Anomic means socially disorganized, disoriented, or alienated. The anomic type of person feels humiliated by external events like a bankruptcy. The disappointed type feels let down by his family, as if the social order is crumbling. And the paranoid type feels his kin is under the threat from outsiders. So to stave off that threat, he takes it upon himself to murder them all. Jeffrey McDonald didn't plan the murders of his family for any of those reasons. No one believes he actually planned these murders at all. That is not disputed. What he did was strike out in rage at his wife during a fight. But when he fatally hit his daughter Kimberly with that club, everything changed. And then the murder of Kristen was premeditated. So to me, he represents a fifth type, the self-preservationist. He does have some characteristics in common with other family annihilators, though. According to criminologist David Wilson, family annihilators are typically previously unknown to the criminal justice system or mental health services. He explains, quote, "For all intents and purposes, these were loving husbands and good fathers, often holding down high-profile jobs and seen publicly as being very, very successful." I don't think Jeffrey McDonald was a loving husband or a good father, but he sure put up a good act up until that cold night in February of 1970. And he was definitely seen publicly as successful and high-achieving. On July 29, 1980, a panel of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed McDonald's conviction in a 2-to-1 split on the grounds that the 9-year delay in bringing him to trial violated his Sixth Amendment rights to a speedy trial. On August 22, 1980, he was freed on $100,000 bail. He returned to work at St. Mary's Medical Center in Long Beach while the Supreme Court heard oral arguments and made their decision. On March 31, 1982, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that McDonald's rights to a speedy trial had not been violated. He was rearrested and returned to federal prison, and his original sentence of 3 consecutive life terms was reinstated. Janet Malcolm, writing for The New Yorker, wrote a 2-piece article titled The Journalist and the Murderer, and it was published in 1990 about author Joe McGinnis and Jeffrey McDonald, wherein she wrote the famous line, "Every journalist who is not too stupid or too full of himself to notice what is going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible." The irony of producing a true crime podcast is not lost on me, but neither is the hypocrisy in Malcolm's article, especially considering she found that Jeffrey McDonald in person seemed, quote, "sturdy, unremarkable, and incapable of such a crime." Exactly what are her credentials to evaluate his character? No, Joe McGinnis was not a psychiatrist. He did, however, spend the better part of a year with Jeffrey McDonald, and then 3 more years researching and writing the case. He was in a much better position to determine Jeffrey's character than Ms. Malcolm. Janet Malcolm insisted that Joe McGinnis tricked Jeffrey McDonald, a claim that McGinnis responded to in the epilogue of a later edition of Fatal Vision. Joe McGinnis said the repeated legal wranglings with McDonald were exhausting and expensive. He settled out of court so it would just stop, but he never stopped defending his story, his research, and his insight into this horrific case. And I will also never stop defending his book. Errol Morris is a filmmaker most famous for the documentary The Thin Blue Line. It is groundbreaking work, considered a classic. He also wrote about Joe McGinnis and Fatal Vision in a book called A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. I have read his book, and much like Janet Malcolm, he chose to ignore so much of the evidence that his book has zero credibility. His writing leaves much to be desired, and he relies on righteousness and sarcasm without any real strong argument against McDonald's trial. He is dead wrong about Joe McGinnis and Jeffrey McDonald. I'm almost as disappointed in his trash talk as I am of Christine Mumma from the Innocence Project working on this case. It's probably not surprising to anyone familiar with the OJ case to see Barry Scheck's name on Jeffrey McDonald's DNA appeals, but I admit it stung a bit to see Christine Mumma's, from the North Carolina Center of Actual Innocence. The same woman who worked so tirelessly to free wrongly convicted and actual innocent man, Willie Grimes. I covered his case in episode 15. It's difficult to grapple with the reverence I hold for the Innocence Project, with some of the lawyers who not only founded it, but still work towards freeing the wrongly accused. We have not only that sellout, Barry Scheck, who testified for the defense in O.J. Simpson's murder trial, but another respected attorney, Christine Mumma, who sold out for Jeffrey McDonald. In case you didn't notice, these cases have some things in common. Two successful, gregarious men accused of heinous murders against their loved ones. A plethora of physical blood evidence. And just as in the OJ case, all they could do was criticize the way the evidence was collected. Just like DNA doesn't jump from one item to another, blood types don't magically change either. Two sensational murder trials, some 16 years apart, and yet so much in common. Specifically, slick, expensive lawyers who excel at smoke and mirrors. In my opinion, the major difference is the McDonald jury was not inflamed by racist rhetoric. No amount of, hey, look over here at the corrupt police, could make the McDonald jury lose sight of what really happened in that house. And guess what? We now have the DNA to shut Jeffrey McDonald down. On March 10, 2006, DNA test results were publicly released that cleared Helena Stokely for good. And also a boyfriend of hers that was investigated, though he had an alibi. She was not in that house. The DNA also proved that a hair in Colette's hand came from Jeffrey McDonald. During the original investigation in 1970, and later at his trial in 1979, the prosecution could not say with certainty where that hair had come from. Now it has been proven. The hair clutched in Colette McDonald's bloody hand came from her husband, Jeffrey McDonald. Not some mysterious druggy murderer that was never found. It was her husband's, the father of her children. Jeffrey McDonald is serving his sentence at a federal prison in Maryland. He continues to maintain his innocence. His projected release date, after serving three consecutive life terms, is April 5, 2071, when he would be 128 years old. So yes, he will die in prison. I had originally intended to cover this case in three parts, so that I could take you through every appeal in the McDonald case that has dragged on for close to 40 years. But I am willing to bet, dear listener, that I don't need to, that you would be rolling your eyes and fast-forwarding. I will fill you in on his latest appeal to the Fourth Circuit Court, brought in early 2017. Jeffrey McDonald is challenging a judge's refusal to grant him a new trial in 2014 based on supposed new evidence in the case. Three hairs found at the crime scene don't match the family's DNA, and there is also a statement from Jimmy Britt, a federal marshal who transported Helena Stokely for trial, who claimed he heard her confess, but that prosecutor Jim Blackburn intimidated her. Jimmy Britt is now dead, but it's telling that he did not come forward for 25 years after the trial. It just so happens that records of federal marshals' transportation of prisoners are usually destroyed after 25 years. So instead of coming forward in 1979, when this supposedly happened, He waited for 25 years until he thought he could not be proven wrong to insert himself into this case. Well, the records were not destroyed in the usual time allotted, and they prove he was never alone with Helena Stokely. He was one of four marshals that transported her and was never privy to any conversations between Stokely and Prosecutor Jim Blackburn. And as for the three hairs found at the scene, lead prosecutor for the Justice Department pointed out that, quote, "This was a busy apartment with a young family with scores of people around them. There was a dog hair on the bed. Was that evidence of intruders? The McDonald's didn't own a dog." Appellate Judge Diana Motz also questioned how the hair evidence helped Jeffrey McDonald's case because it did not match Helena Stokely's DNA either. She told Jeffrey McDonald's attorneys, "It's not as though you have this hair tied to another person of interest." There is no way to know when the Fourth Circuit Court will finally make their decision. In one of McDonald's many appeals, they took over a year to make a ruling. But personally, I don't think this latest bullshit appeal will do anything. It just proves that Jeffrey McDonald, at 74 years old, is still a narcissistic asshole intent on getting out of prison. So I won't bore you with the inane details of the past four decades of appeals. But if you are curious, I certainly encourage you to read up on it. I would also encourage you to read every book, not just Joe McGinnis's Fatal Vision, but also those that support McDonald, so you do get both sides. There are also extremely valuable resources on the internet now where you can read the Article 32 hearing transcripts as well as those from his trial. Was McDonaldCaseFacts.com. Another is the JeffreyMcDonaldCase.com. It is maintained by Colette's living relatives, but you can see the original documents, crime scene, and autopsy photos for yourself. And there are some that are still hung up on McDonald's supposed lack of motive. I get that, and so do many involved in this case. Joe McGinnis, who passed away in 2014, had said, quote, "He's a psychopath. He doesn't have the kind of emotions that you and I would have. He doesn't have the capacity to feel bad about it. These weren't his wife and children. These were people that got in his way." And Prosecutor Brian Murtaugh had an even more insightful motive in regards to the cold-blooded stabbing of Kristen McDonald. He told a Washington Post reporter in 2012, quote, "He had to do it because it's so unthinkable. That was the one, the cold one, that no jury would believe a father could do." He's right. Jeffrey McDonald bet his own freedom on the fact that he thought no one would believe a father could do that to his own flesh and blood. But we know better now. It's monsters like Jeffrey McDonald who taught us what many fathers and husbands are capable of. And I would like to point something else out that may already be obvious to you. Occam's razor has become a trope that I've grown weary of, but it's a trope because it's true. If you are unfamiliar with that phrase, it's a scientific principle that the simplest solution tends to be the right one. I think that principle can be applied here. Instead of four mysterious drug addicts who were never found, we have a man who was there that night and was not grievously injured. Tell me how it makes sense that Jeffrey McDonald's family was so viciously and gruesomely attacked with multiple stab wounds from multiple weapons, and he had only one real wound. How would four deranged psycho killers mercilessly stab a woman and little children and yet leave the man, the pig, the epitome of all they were supposedly raging against, alive? He claimed while he was still on the scene that he helped drug addicts, so-called acid heads. If that was true and these were addicts with a vendetta against him, why couldn't he identify them? Why couldn't he produce even one name as a possible suspect when asked? Because it is not true. There is no real evidence suggesting that anyone was in that home that night other than the McDonald family. Colette's older brother, Bob Stevenson, was very close to his sister and nieces and was also devastated by their deaths. Bob chose to remain in the background in the years following the murders. He let his stepfather, Freddie Kassab, fight publicly for the conviction of Jeffrey McDonald. But since Freddie's death in 1994, Bob has become active in the media, vehemently and eloquently advocating for his sister and nieces. And I would also like to point out another man that I probably admire most in this case, Brian Murtaugh. He was a federal prosecutor in the early 70s when the McDonald case landed on his desk. In the nearly 50 years since, he has had many job offers from elite law firms all over the country. But Brian Murtaugh chose to remain a government employee on a government salary for his entire career. His chosen career path was to fight every appeal and ensure that Jeffrey McDonald would never walk out into the sunshine, a free man. Brian Murtaugh is nothing less than a hero in my eyes. And Jeffrey McDonald will forever be the epitome of evil, of selfishness, of cold, calculated brutality. He is the original family annihilator, a narcissist that destroyed his entire family to save himself. May he rot in hell. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. You can also listen directly from Spreaker, my network online, or on their app. And I'm also on Stitcher, CastBox, and many other podcatchers. If you are interested in supporting the show, I have a Patreon page with many different rewards for different levels of donation. Or you can visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, where you can make a one-time donation just by hitting the donate button. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I am also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing the McDonald case or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It is linked to my Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.